go follow and implement it. You know the way to do things. You just go around it. Imam says, if I'm in this state that I know one decision is pleasing you and the other decision is displeasing you, give me strength. Incline me. Give me love. Make that decision that is pleasing you becoming my favorite decision so that my heart gets purified of my personal preferences, my worldly preferences, and it only focuses on what is it that you prefer, on what is it that pleases you. This is super duper important, and this is something that we need to ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to change that root of inclination, that root of decision making, that which we call it love. If we love Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, truly one of the signs is that every decision that we make, the very first question is this: if I'm going to get married to that certain person, if I'm going to do that certain program in my educational journey, if there is that certain decision that I make, the very first question that I ask myself and use my intellect and guidance of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, of course, is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala pleased with this or not? Oh Allah, keep us in the path of your pleasure and satisfaction, and do not let us be amongst those who displease you. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mahdi in the program Bridge on RIB English Radio.
هرگز نگیرد تا ابد آقا کسی جای تو را، هرگز مخواه از کف دهم عشق و تولای تو را.
Midstream.
The delay in Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah's appearance was not ordinary. While it is true that there is an aspect related to intentional ambiguity aimed at unsettling the enemy, there's another aspect related to reaching a decision regarding the course of action for the resistance in Lebanon and the region in defense of Palestine and in the face of Israeli occupation on one hand and its Western, especially American supporters on the other. While the leader of the Hezbollah resistance in Lebanon announced largely reflected the common perception of the entire axis of resistance, Nasrullah is known to be the most influential figure within the axis, possessing detailed information about all the arenas. It was his task to re-explain the reality in light of what happened in Palestine, from the Al-Aqsa flood operation to the ongoing battles in Gaza, as well as the American and Western military buildup supporting the Israeli entity in the region. What Sayyid Nasrullah said on November 3rd can be described as the political preamble to a new path that the resistance in Lebanon will take, one that the rest of the Axis forces will follow. When he explicitly talked about the two goals of stopping the aggression on Gaza and working to achieve a victory for Hamas and the resistance there, he practically set a high political bar. This means that the resistance has entered a new phase at the military operations level, which is expected in the near future. It's anticipated that Sayyid Nasrullah's second appearance later this week on the occasion of the Martyrs' Day will provide an opportunity to discuss this path, the nature of the threats within it, the mechanism of action, and preparing public opinion for the requirements of this stage on multiple levels. However, the most important part of his speech was spinning the U.S. as entirely responsible for the ongoing war in Gaza, stressing that America is the one preventing the cessation of aggression on Gaza and rejecting any ceasefire resolution, and it's the Americans who are running the war. which is why, as Sayyid Nasrallah explained, the decision of the Islamic resistance in Iraq to attack American bases in Iraq and Syria is a wise and courageous decision, increasing his own resistance level of threats against the U.S. forces, reminding them how they left Beirut in the 80s with their tails between their legs. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Popular and political reactions to the speech of Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah range from those who welcomed the fact that the resistance leader did not act emotionally despite the harshness of the Palestinian moment, to those who acted with disappointment because they believed or bet on more harsh positions against the occupation. Let us be clear. The people of Gaza Strip are the only ones who have the right to demand more from Hezbollah and its leader. But the matter turns into a sick joke when comments are made by people or entities that historically represent the anti-resistance line. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Ibrahim Moussaoui, member of the Lebanese Parliament in the Loyalty to the Resistance Bloc Hezbollah. A pleasure to have you on with us, Dr. Moussaoui. Now, Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah's first speech since October 7th, the Al-Aqsa flood operation in Gaza, was described as a difficult moment speech far from emotions. Do you think that this is an accurate description of Hezbollah's chief's speech?
Yes, of course, actually. Thank you for giving the opportunity, first of all. Second, when you are in a very sensitive and tough juncture of history, of time, of events, you depend on leaders who have the full judgment, the full wisdom in order to handle such a matter. My understanding, which many share me, is that the kind of speech that has been given by Sayyid Nasrallah after 3 or 4 weeks of the Gaza aggression by the Israelis was this kind of speech was historical, was remarkable, and I'm not saying this because I want to praise Sayyid Nasrallah. He does not lack any praise, and he's not waiting for me to praise him or anyone else. We are talking here, and we have to focus on a very important, sensitive juncture of history and time that has to do with all of the sacrifices of the resistance, with all of the achievements of the resistance, and with all of the aspirations and future plans of the resistance. Sayyid Nasrallah was very clear. And the kind of threats, the kind of menace that he's directed to the Israelis, which they read very carefully and thoroughly, I believe is enough to give a full image about the kind of events that will unfold in the future. The kind of threat that he managed to give to the Israelis in a very delicate and a very thorough and in a very precise way is very important as well. And I believe those who are sitting there in their offices, taking sips of coffee or whatever, and then delivering speeches or making comments, I believe they should be respectful enough as to respect the sacrifices of the resistance everywhere. Now we are talking about one resistance. We are talking about Gaza, we are talking about Lebanon, we are talking about all those who believe in the resistance against the oppression, against the tyranny, and against the world arrogance. That's why, because we are in such a very sensitive moment, we should focus only on the things that should be done. Secondly, and most importantly, they should understand that there is a complete and continuous reaction and coordination between the different factions and the different wings of the resistance in Palestine, in Lebanon, in different areas. They know how to manage this. I mean, we cannot leave this for the commentators, not for myself, not for anyone. We are talking about an arena of struggle against the Israelis. We are talking about an ongoing war. And when it's that, leave the things to be decided, to the leaders to decide it. And they know better what
to
do.
But the issue
is that once you have this trust, once you have this credibility, we should be at ease.
But Dr. Moussaoui, as we said, the reactions were some who were with, some who were disappointed. What were they disappointed with? What is it that they wanted Hezbollah to do that would satisfy those people, whether it's in Lebanon or elsewhere, despite the fact that we already said these people usually are anti-resistance? But what is the disappointment with? What do they want?
Look, the same people who don't want the resistance to fight, who don't want the resistance to exist, are the harsh critics on the resistance, and they want the resistance to wage a full-fledged war against the Israelis. Actually, this is not something that could be left to the temperament and to the mood of people. Here we are talking about an issue that has to do, as I said earlier, to the history, achievements, and to the future and aspirations and plans of the axis of the resistance. And this is not should be, it shouldn't be in any way a kind of temperamental decision for this and that. The kind of expectations that they put, why do people feel frustrated? Why do they get disappointed? Because they make expectations according to their own calculations. Mm-hmm. We cannot put the resistance in a position that is according to someone's calculations or to someone's, if you want, aspirations.
But that
it
being
should be
said,
the calculation, the precise calculation of
definitely.
The resistance, the leaders
but,
of the resistance,
but that,
and the coordination
said,
between the different
Dr.
parts of the resistance
factions. That being
factions.
Very clear, what has the resistance so far deterred the Israeli entity from doing, the Lebanese resistance?
Well, of course, I mean, it's evident, you can see it every day. After only one day of the resistance operation against the Israelis after the 7th of October, on the 8th of October, the resistance started this kind of engagement, military engagement with the Israeli outposts all over the Lebanese Palestinian border. You're talking about a front which extends from Nakura up to the Kfar Shuba and Shiba farms. You're talking about more than 120 kilometer length of front, and you are talking about engagements with all the different military outposts there. You're talking about having one-third of the Israeli army in the Lebanese-Palestinian front. You are talking about killing tens of Israelis, officers and army soldiers, and you are talking about destroying a lot of the equipments and targeting a lot of the artillery and the tanks of the Israelis that they have always boasted it is the miracle of the Israeli army. So here we are talking about an engagement that has lessened the pressure on Gaza. Here we are talking about a continuous battle that is taking place, and it's open for all choices and for all options at any time.
Well, Dr. Mousawi, Sayyid Nasrallah said in his speech that all options are on the table in Lebanon. How do you think the White House or the Biden administration took that? Because most of his speech was against the U.S. regime and not the Israeli tool, as he explained. How do you think they responded to that?
Well, it's very evident, you know, that the Americans are the one who are using Israel as a tool. The Israelis, I mean, if you talk about the 7th of October, it took them 2 days to come to their senses, to have any kind of sense of judgment, to take decisions or whatever. Maybe the American warships, the American fleet have come to the area before the Israelis made their decisions to respond or to rebuttal the whole thing that happened to them on the 7th of October. Here we are talking about the upper hand. The upper hand in this is for the Americans. Hadn't it been for the Americans, the Israelis, I mean, with this, what's happening now, would have been actually dealt another and another and another devastating blow from the Palestinian and from the axis of the resistance. The kind of the kind of hurry that and the speedy intervention of the Americans in the region, in Palestine, in the Mediterranean, where they sent most of their warships here, tells you a lot about how fragile, weak, and how feeble is the Israeli army and the Israeli entity as a whole. And the decision has been made by the Americans. We remember the 2006 war when the Israelis wanted to stop the war in the 10th day and the Americans didn't allow them and they kept postponing this. The same is happening now. They are playing, they are making a play and in the eyes of the people that the Americans are trying to seek a kind of truce in order to pass certain humanitarian aid or whatever, but it seems very evident that the Americans are pressing on the Israeli army, on the Israeli military personnel, in order to make any kind of achievement on the ground before they go into anything else. The Americans are the ones who are not accepting a kind of ceasefire. And I tell you, these are information. A week or 10 days ago, they were about to go into a truce and to make this kind of sweep, in order to free the prisoners, to free the captives, the Palestinian captives, and to make this kind of swap. What happened is that the American intervention stopped this and freeze it. That's why I believe, Sayyid Nasrallah was very clear that what we are doing here is that we're not only fighting the Israelis, it's not about the Israelis anymore, it's about the Americans and the Western alliance that has hurried in order to give a hand of aid to the Israelis.
Definitely, which is why I'm going to need you to stay with us, Dr. Moussaoui, ladies and gents, and you too stay with us, because right after this transition, we're going to see how the U.S. threatened to destroy Lebanon.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Now, the White House stated that the United States does not want to see the conflict between Hamas and Israel expand into Lebanon. This is what they said. However, the U.S. escalated on its own that it is unimaginable to imagine the potential devastation that would befall Lebanon and its people if the conflict expands. In a direct threat to Lebanon in the event it keeps up the open confrontation with Zionist Israel. More details in the following report.
This was clear enough for the U.S. regime to understand that all possibilities of the Lebanese front escalating further are on the table. Rolling into a broader war is a realistic scenario that can happen in Lebanon, and the enemy is now taking this into account. We must all be prepared for all forthcoming scenarios. This is how Sayyid Nasrallah threatened the U.S. regime in response to their deployment of warships and aircraft carriers in the eastern Mediterranean as a way of supposedly deterring Hezbollah from further escalating the confrontation with Israeli occupation forces in South Lebanon. The USS Ford carrier, for instance, includes a nuclear reactor, can hold more than 75 military aircrafts, including fighter aircrafts like the F-18 Super Hornet jets and the E-2 Hawkeye, which can act as an early warning system. It has an arsenal of missiles like the Evolved Sea Sparrow missile, which is a medium-range surface-to-air missile used to counter drones and aircrafts. Meanwhile, the Dwight Eisenhower Carrier Strike Group, also known as the Ike, has 5,000 sailors and can carry up to 9 squadrons of aircrafts like fighter jets, helicopters, and those capable of carrying out intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance operations. Much like the Ford, the Ike carrier will be accompanied by other ships like the guided missile cruiser Philippine Sea, guided missile destroyers Gravely, and the Mason. The U.S. took Sayyid Nasrallah's threats seriously that they sent in their top diplomat, Secretary of State Antony Blinken, to meet with West Asian leaders in Amman, Jordan, on Saturday. Sharp divides persisted between the United States and the Arab states on their response to the Israeli occupation's war against Gaza. Blinken then concluded his short visit to Tel Aviv late on Saturday, leaving behind endless questions about what he said to Israeli entity officials behind closed doors meetings and what negotiations and agreements were reached. However, it can be estimated that the stumbling of the ground operation in Gaza and the departure of the goal to crush Hamas from the realm of possibility imposed itself on the visit, with some believing that this setback, along with open threats from Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, were two of its most significant causes. Blinken's visit appears to be more of a reaction to the field results, most notably the resilience of the Gaza resistance, which prompted the Israeli entity to freeze the ground operation in its initial phase. It also appears to be driven by the factor of time, which has become pressing for the U.S. administration, especially as there is no clear strategic horizon or results for further fighting.
Now we continue from Beirut with Dr. Ibrahim Moussaoui, member of the Lebanese parliament in the loyalty to the resistance bloc Hezbollah. Thanks again for your time, Dr. Moussaoui. Now, before the speech of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, the Pentagon actually deployed two aircraft carriers along with their supporting ships to the Eastern Mediterranean to supposedly support the Israeli entity. Yet most of the group of battleships is docking facing the coastal line of Lebanon and not occupied Palestine. Now, after the speech, one U.S. official, as we heard, said that the level of destruction that Lebanon will see will be immense in the event Hezbollah escalates the confrontation. How seriously do you and Hezbollah take those threats?
Well, first of all, we have to understand that when they try to wipe out Gaza from the map, when they make this kind of genocidal war against the Palestinians, when they wipe out total neighborhoods with all of the families there, when they kill more than like 4,000, now they are going to be around 4,000 children, when they kill 10,000 people, two-thirds of them, or maybe the majority of them, the sweeping majority of them are children and women, this tells you how coward and how creepy they are and what kind of enemies we are fighting. They didn't and weren't in any position to fight the Palestinians like man to man, or they come to ground. They are only carpet bombing Gaza Strip. They are only using 2-ton weight bombs against the residential areas, against the hospitals. And this is very telling about what they want to send of a message. But I'll tell you, we're not be threatened. We're not going to be intimidated. We're not going to be threatened by this kind of escalation by the Israelis. The existence of Israel is an escalation in the face of humanity. When they say that Hezbollah escalate or not escalate, we are talking here about one axis. They give themselves the right to come from 10,000 miles abroad, bring just what you said, the aircraft war carriers in order to bombard the area, and they put them in the Mediterranean, I mean close to Lebanon, not to Palestine, in order to tell the Israelis, you go do your job against the Palestinians, we will handle Hezbollah. This is what they said from the beginning, and they threatened. I tell you, it's not a matter of threat or whatever. We make our calculations in a very precise way. We have a leadership that has always been keen, that has always been precise, that has always been wise in order to take the right decision in the right time. The timing of everything should be in the hand of the resistance. And the kind of fight against them is meticulously and precisely calculated in the head of the resistance. And that's why we have this kind of phasing. And Sayyid Nasrallah has put all options on the table, and they should understand very well that they have no guarantee that things will not unfold into more escalation anytime, anywhere. That's why I believe this kind of reaction by Sayyid Nasrallah against the threats has been very strong and has echoed and resounded in a very strong way in their ears and in their lobbies and in their offices. That's why we pin the hopes that, and we are very sure that the resistance in Palestine itself has not been touched. We should understand that Gaza and Hamas, they are there. And the different Palestinian resistance fighters, their factions, they are in a very strong position. What the only thing that we see and you see and everybody is seeing is the bombardment and wiping out, annihilating of civilians, the genocidal war against the children. But when you talk about military achievements, they have none. Mm-hmm. None of the achievements have been done by
Dr.
the Israelis.
Well, Dr. Moussaoui, as you said, the speech of Sayyid Nasrallah did echo a lot in the hallways of the Western decision makers. But U.S., which is why they actually sent in their top diplomats, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, who met with the Lebanese Prime Minister or caretaker Prime Minister Najib Miqati in Jordan on Saturday, and Blinken stressed the importance of ensuring that the Israeli entity / Hamas conflict does not spread elsewhere. Now, you and I, we both know that this is not why he made Najib Miqati fly all the way to Jordan so he could meet with him. What was the message that he sent back with Miqati specifically to you and Hezbollah?
Well, look, I mean, they know very well. Sayyid Nasrallah made it very clear that many messages have been sent through everybody. I mean, everybody. You won't believe who were the people who were handing the messages. But Hezbollah has decided not to listen to any message. You know, Hezbollah is in a position to calculate the things in a very good way. They know well the Lebanese domestic interests. They know very well that this kind of defense is saving Lebanon, that if Hamas won the war in Gaza, if the Palestinians won the war in Gaza, then Lebanon is victorious, is going to emerge victorious. If Hamas loses, God forbid, and they are not going to lose, and I can assure you, will emerge victorious. If they lost the war, God forbid, you know, I mean, this is going to be a great loss for all of the surrounding, all of the Arabs, all of the Muslims, all of the humanity, and more importantly and particularly the surrounding regions to Palestine. I mean, Egypt, Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, and other countries. So, I mean, it's not a matter of listening to the messages or whatever. The Hezbollah position is very clear, is very strong, and it's very clear, and at the same time, being ambiguous a little bit, the kind of constructive ambiguity that Sayyid Nasrallah talked about, this is a strategy by the resistance that will keep the enemies busy minding and managing and calculating, making their own calculations, and they should continue to do it at any time. But I can tell you things are very open for all options at any time.
Mm-hmm. Well, but we have seen as well throughout these 3 or 4 weeks, the U.S. occupation bases across Syria and Iraq being targeted by specifically the Iraqi resistance factions and some Syrian resistance factions as well because of their support to Zionist Israel. But what is the red line that Hezbollah will not allow to see U.S. and Israeli entity troops cross before fully escalating the current confrontations into a full-fledged war? What is it that might break the balance that would push Hezbollah into a big war?
We are not in a position to tell anything about this. All of the intelligence apparatuses are in a continuous, they are seeking to understand Hezbollah, to understand what is it, what's the red line. I believe they understand it, and we have to let them, if you want to drown in their calculations and not understand. The resistance, the leader of the resistance, the leadership of the resistance has done everything in order to make the preparation for any escalation, for any full-fledged war that would happen or erupt in the region. And they have the decision, and they know when to take the decision, and when they know when to carry out the surgeon. If we are ambiguous about this, then this is because it will help in the fight that is taking place, that is going on. We don't want to open up, and I'm not part of the leadership, of the military leadership, or the leadership that takes the decision, but I understand very well that our leadership is wise enough as to clarify or not clarify the steps and the things that would better and best suit the ongoing war now.
Mm-hmm. We have no doubt in that. Dr. Ibrahim Moussaoui, member of the Lebanese Parliament in the Loyalty to the Resistance Bloc Hezbollah, thanks a million for your time, for joining us. And I know that you gave us this exclusively after being not able to join media outlets. So thank you for trusting for your first appearance on media after the October 7 Al-Aqsa flood operation. Ladies and gents, thank you. Hopefully, inshallah, we'll see you all next week on the media stream.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
In the limelight.
Declining U.S. consumer confidence has cast shadows over its economy. According to reports, the U.S. consumer confidence is the lowest it's been in 4 months. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to China Daily, consumer sentiment is often regarded as the barometer of the U.S. economy, given that nearly 70% of it relies on consumer spending. However, recent data reveals a gradual decline in consumer confidence over the past few months, posing a potential threat to the holiday season. Data released by the Conference Board recently shows that its Consumer Confidence Index fell to 103 in September from 108.7, marking the most significant monthly drop since December 2020. According to Reuters, U.S. consumer confidence dropped to a four-month low in September, weighed down by persistent worries about higher prices and rising fears of a recession, though households remain generally upbeat about the labor market. The second straight monthly decline in confidence reported by the Conference Board recently also reflected higher interest rates and concerns about the political environment. The nation faces a potentially disruptive shutdown of the federal government amid political wrangling. Confidence fell across all age groups and was most pronounced among consumers with annual incomes of $50,000 or more. Christopher Ropke, chief economist at FWD Bands in New York, said inflation is slowing, but prices are still higher than they were before the pandemic, and this is taking a toll on consumer confidence. The Conference Board said its Consumer Confidence Index dropped to 103 this month, the lowest reading since May, from an upwardly revised 108.7 in August. Economists polled by Reuters had forecast the index easing to 105.5 from the previously reported 106.1. Consumers' perceptions of the likelihood of a recession over the next year ticked back up. A sharp decrease in the expectations measure accounted for the decline in confidence, which economists partially attributed to the looming government shutdown, with Congress so far failing to pass any spending bills to fund federal agency programs in the fiscal year starting on October 1st. Hundreds of thousands of federal workers will be furloughed, and a wide range of services, from economic data releases to nutrition benefits, suspended beginning. Dana Peterson, chief economist at the Conference Board in Washington, said consumers also expressed concerns about the political situation and higher interest rates. The cutoff date for the preliminary survey was September 18th. Millions of Americans will also start repaying their student loans in October, and most have run down their pandemic savings. The survey showed consumers increasingly concerned about their family finances. The Federal Reserve last week left its benchmark overnight interest rate unchanged at the 5.25% to 5.50% range. The U.S. Central Bank, however, stiffened its hawkish stance, projecting another rate hike by year-end and monetary policy staying significantly tighter through 2024 than previously expected. The Fed has hiked the policy rate by 525 basis points since March 2022. A separate from the Commerce Department showed new home sales plunged 8.7% to a seasonally adjusted annual rate of 675,000 units in August after rising to a 17-month high in July. Economists had forecast new home sales, which account for a small share of U.S. home sales, falling to a rate of 700,000 units. New home sales are counted as the signing of a contract, making them a leading indicator of the housing market. They, however, can be volatile on a month-to-month basis. Sales increased 5.8% on a year-on-year basis in August. Though new home sales remain supported by a dearth of previously owned homes on the market, the resurgence in mortgage rates is reducing affordability for prospective home buyers. The rate on the 30-year fixed mortgage vaulted above 7% in August and climbed to an average of 7.19%, the highest since July 2001, according to data from the mortgage finance agency Freddie Mac. Mortgage rates are rising in tandem with U.S. Treasury yields, which have surged on worries that soaring oil prices could hamper the Fed's fight against inflation. Nancy Vanden Heuten, lead U.S. economist at Oxford Economics in New York, said, "While we expect higher rates to hurt new home sales, we think they will be more resilient than existing home sales as builders seem willing to scale up their use of incentives to motivate sales." A third report from the Federal Housing Finance Agency showed annual home price growth quickened for a second straight month in July, largely reflecting the tight supply in the market for previously owned homes. House prices jumped 4.6% on a year-on-year basis in July. After rising 3.2% in June, prices shot up 0.8% month-on-month after advancing 0.4% in June. The resurgence in house prices was seen feeding through to higher inflation, likely giving the Fed cover to maintain its hawkish posture for some time. Bill Adams, chief economist at Commercial Bank in Dallas, said the Fed will see the re-acceleration of house prices as a reason to keep interest rates higher for longer. Renting households are seeing some relief in new lease prices, but since two-thirds of Americans are homeowners, the Fed cannot afford to look past house prices' influence on the cost of living.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray five times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, in which we try to ask and answer some of the questions related to the Islamic laws based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before we embark on our episode, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini. The
son of Ayatollah Ha'iri, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'iri, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum salam, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Well, we are going to talk about some of the jurisprudential laws on, wudu or anything related to that dimension. Well, based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei, of course. Sheikh Javid, in doing the wudu by immersion, is it somehow permissible to submerge the face and the hands, of course, into the water more than 2 times?
Well, first of all, I would like to say that just as we can perform like ghusl by way of immersion, we can also make wudu by way of immersing our face and our hands underwater in a quick succession. Like, for example, you just do it at once without doing it slowly. You just submerge your face underwater, and that's considered as one wash. That's permissible. There are many people who think that, okay, wudu irtimasi is not okay, it's not in order, and of course one should wash his face in the very usual manner.
Mm.
That's not the case, okay? If you are in a hurry, you want to put your face into water, submerge it, it's okay. You can do it once or twice, but of course you cannot do it for 3 times, because we do know that washing your face and hands for 3 times is forbidden. Now, the same is the case with washing your arms. Immersing your arms underwater and making wudu by way of immersion, there is absolutely no problem.
Mm-hmm, I see. Sheikh Javid, you know that, and you also referred to it in some of the previous episodes, oil, for example, can prevent the water from reaching the skin, especially when you're about to make wudu or ghusl. So it needs to be removed first, right? And then dealt with the wudu or the ghusl. We are talking about, my question is regarding those people who have some kind of hyperactive, for example, oily glands.
You're right.
All right, or secretions on their skins, and they usually make more secretions than the normal human beings. Is that considered a kind of barrier for wudu?
Of course, it's not considered a kind of barrier, and I've seen no religious authorities considering it as a kind of barrier, because if that's to be considered a barrier, then of course it will create a problem. It's a kind of problem which is not bearable, and commonly it's not, it cannot be tolerated, because you will face many problems while performing ghusl, the major ablution, while making wudu. You will consider thinking of how to remove it, how to get rid of that secretion, and that's not possible. That will make it a kind of create obsession for you.
Yes.
And that's why the Islamic Sharia does not consider it as a barrier. When it comes to applying oil, that's something else. Of course, that is that should be removed, because it definitely creates a kind of a barrier.
I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break, and we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Mohammed Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini around wudu. Sheikh Javid, stuff or ointment or oil or whatever may actually cause some kind of a barrier, or be considered as kind of barrier for the wudu actually to be actualized. But my question is regarding the nail polish or fake nails that some women in fact are wearing. Are they considered as barriers to make wudu? How are they supposed to make wudu with them on?
Okay, that's one of the most frequently asked questions, as far as I know, because a lot of people ask, a lot of ladies ask as to whether it's permissible for them to wear nail polish. Of course, wearing nail polish is permissible per se. Ladies who are in their menses, ladies who, for example, who are experiencing childbirth bleeding, since they do not perform prayers and they are not required, and of course it's not permissible for them to pray, so they can wear the nail polish, fake nails, or the nail polish, the nail polish. But when of course they are supposed to perform ghusl or made to make wudu, the nail polish must be removed. And of course sometimes it becomes very difficult for a lady to remove the nail polish, because it's time consuming to remove the nail polish. Sometimes it's not even possible for a woman to make sure that there's no substance left on their nails. Okay, they remove the nail polish thinking that they have removed it, but after completing their prayers and maybe after a few hours, they look at their nails and see some black dots, some tiny particles still left on their nails. So again, they have to remove it, and then they have to repeat their prayers. And this happens many times for ladies, for women and girls. So also, when it comes to different types of nail polish, again, this is another important question which is asked very much frequently by ladies. The nail polish could be of different types. Some of them are water permeable, some of them are water friendly, they call it. And these nail polish, you know, types of nail polish which are available on the market, they cannot, you know, they will not allow, even if they are called water permeable, they do not allow water to go to reach the nail plates. Because where they, I wonder, where the nail polish stands, mm-hmm. when a woman makes wuzu, so it is, you know, it is somewhere on the nails. So yes. It will prevent water from reaching the nails. Therefore, you never become certain that water reaches your nails.
Mm.
Okay? In order to make sure that water reaches the nails, it is definitely necessary to remove the nail polish, no matter what the name or what the brand or whatever the type of the nail polish, because you will not be certain in the existence of nail polish on your nails.
Just quite similar to the question that I asked you around or about the nail polish and what they do, they have to remove it, as you said, right?
Yes.
Before making wudu. What about the eyelash extension? Some women also are wearing some extensions to their lashes, you know? Should they remove it?
Unfortunately, it is becoming a very common phenomenon. We see ladies using wearing you know, fake lashes, and they just wear these lashes to make themselves presentable, make themselves beautiful, you know. This is a kind of cosmetic you know, tool or something, and therefore according to the religious authorities, eyelashes also form a kind of barrier, because they are glued to the real lashes, and they are not natural. They are, you know, people, cosmetic experts, they use some kind of, you know, adhesive or something, you know, you know, liquid to get those fake lashes glued to the eyelids or to the real lashes. And then it remains there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of, you know, difficult to even remove the eyelashes.
Yes.
And so what will be the consequences? If those mm-hmm. lashes are there, the wudu made by a woman will be affected. It mm-hmm. will be, and the same is the case with the ghusl she performs.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Ravi. And thank you, my dear listeners, actually, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jad, as the host of this program, and the rest of the crew here on IRIB English Radio. Say, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun Rahimun Mannanun Kareemun Salamun Aleemun Malajan ilaha illahum Ghaffarun Jameelun Wahhabun Latifun Tawwabun Samiun Basir La ilaha illahum Wahid محيٍ مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Deadline's rights groups expressed concern over the safety of civilians sheltering at hospitals in Gaza as Israel keeps pounding the facilities.